On behalf of ASMSU, I'd like to welcome you. Our speaker for today is Mark Lane. Mr. Lane's involvement with the assassination of President Kennedy began in December 1963 when he wrote an article that was an analysis of the district attorney's case against Oswald. This prompted Mrs. Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, to appoint him to represent her son's interest at the Warren Commission. The commissioner refused to accept him as Lee Harvey Oswald's counsel, but it did permit him to testify. Thus began a three-year investigation into the circumstances of President Kennedy's assassination. The results of his research and his conclusions comprise his book, Rush to Judgment. The Warren Commission report left many doubts. Did the Warren Commission suppress evidence of a conspiracy? And how many bullets hit President Kennedy? The man most responsible for these doubts is New York attorney Mark Lane. Since he began his investigation in 1963, and since the publication of his book, Rush to Judgment, he has been called everything from a liar to a national hero. His book prompted Norman Mayer, who reviewed it, to say the following. Three cheers for Mark Lane. His book proves once and forever that the assassination of President Kennedy is more of a mystery today than when it occurred. Ladies and gentlemen, let me present Mr. Mark Lane.
You may recall the scene on network television in September of 1964. The commission, all seven members assembled, almost for the first time, to present their finished document to President Johnson, who had appointed them. And Earl Warren held the heavy volume in his hand and held it out to the president. And the president took it in his hand, and a reporter in almost a stage whisper said, "Won't you say something, Mr. President?" President Johnson looked at it and held it and said, "It's very heavy," which may constitute the finest short analysis of the commission's report. For although it does comprise, it does consist of 888 pages, and it is purportedly a summation of some 26 volumes of testimony and evidence, and some additional material, some 1,551 files in the National Archives, the fact is that the Warren Commission itself failed to question the vast majority of the witnesses to the assassination of President Kennedy. They failed to question some of the most important witnesses to the murder of Patrolman Tippit, and they failed to question the majority of the witnesses to the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald. Nevertheless, when the report was issued, it was received with grateful enthusiasm by the media of our country. The New York Times and other responsible newspapers, for example, reported that the Warren Commission report answered every question, resolved every doubt. Men like Louis Neiser, distinguished attorneys, said anyone who now, in his foreword to the Warren Commission report published by Doubleday, anyone now who doubts the Warren Commission report is a neurotic or has financial motives or something worse than that, something more sordid. The remarkable thing about that burst of enthusiasm and endorsement for the report which accompanied its issue in September of 1964 is that the report purports to be nothing more than a fair summation of the 26 volumes of evidence which had not been published at that time. And everyone who endorsed the report when it was issued endorsed a summation without ever having an opportunity to look at the actual evidence to see whether the summation was fair, accurate, and in context. Well, then the evidence was published. The 26 volumes of evidence were released. Just 2 months later, November 23rd, 1964. And now we could see what the evidence actually showed. Writing for the New York Times, Anthony Lewis, then the Washington correspondent for that publication, wrote the story which was given the front page headline, major story of the day. And in it, Mr. Lewis said, "The evidence in the 26 volumes proves conclusively that Earl Warren and his colleagues were correct. Oswald was the one lone unhappy man who assassinated the president by himself." Mr. Lewis made that statement after he had had access to the 26 volumes for 3 1/2 hours. Now, I will concede at the outset that Mr. Lewis reads more quickly than I do. It took me a year and a half to get through that material. Now, I've been anxious to discover why Mr. Lewis felt he was able to summarize the material and issue his opinion to the American people, an editorial opinion which was carried on the front page of the New York Times regarding the contents of the report. The fact is that the careful analysis, or even a cursory analysis, of the evidence shows that in every single instance, save one, the evidence fully rebuts the conclusions of the Warren Commission. There is but one conclusion which the commission reached, which is supported by the evidence, and that is the conclusion that Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald. But of course, that took place on television, and that would be difficult to deny. The role played by the media was more than that of issuing endorsements for the commission. In fact, back on February 21st, 1964, not long after the assassination, Life magazine published a cover photo, and it captioned it, "Lee Oswald with the weapons he used to kill President Kennedy and Officer Tippit." Appears to be a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald holding a rifle in his left hand. On his right hip, there's a pistol. In his left hand, there is both the Worker and the Militant, the publications of the Communist Party and the Trotskyist Party. There is Oswald. Note the shadow from Oswald's nose, those of you who are in the front, and the photographs will be here after the lecture so they can be examined. It falls directly downward, exactly into the middle of his mouth, going neither to the right nor to the left, indicating the sun was almost directly overhead when the picture was taken, when the picture of his head was taken. Now, where was the sun when the picture of his body was taken? Here's the shadow here, going in this direction. The solution, of course, is quite simple. This photograph was taken in a society which enjoyed a dual solar system. Or, in the alternative, Oswald's head was superimposed upon someone else's body, someone who, in fact, posed for the photograph holding a rifle and wearing a pistol and holding those two newspapers. This was the opinion reached almost immediately after the publication of this document by scientific photographic academies throughout the world. In fact, as recently as last October, the London Sunday Times decided that it was going to try to duplicate this photograph and had its leading photographers make the effort, and they concluded that it was impossible to duplicate this photograph. What we did not know at that time, because the 26 volumes of evidence had not been published, the beginning of 1964, was that while Oswald was in custody, he was shown this photograph the day after his arrest, the day before he was shot to death in the police basement. And when shown the photograph, according to the FBI, Secret Service, and Dallas police who were present, Oswald looked at it and said, "That is not a picture of me. It is a picture of my head. It is true, but it's been superimposed on the body. I know enough about photography," he said. He had at one time worked for a photographer, "to know that when this case comes to trial, I will prove on the face of this photograph that it is a composite." Well, of course, the case never came to trial, but the commission did ask me to testify before it, and when I testified before the commission, I brought this photograph to them and raised the question, which is raised by the disparity of the shadows. And the commission seems somewhat concerned about that, sufficiently concerned so that they asked the director of photography for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Lyndall Schoenfeld, if he would see to it that this photograph was copied, duplicated, and examined. And they did duplicate it. They attempted to duplicate it, in fact. An FBI man was asked to go up to the roof of the FBI building in Washington, and he held a rifle in his left hand, and he took a similar stance to the stance taken by the man on the cover of Life magazine, and a photograph was taken, and I show you the exact copy as published by the Warren Commission. There's the FBI agent, and you see the shadow is rather the same. The rifle is held in the same position. Now let's see about the shadow from the nose. It's hard to tell because they removed the head. The agent was asked by the lawyer for the Warren Commission, why have you removed the head of the FBI agent before giving us the photograph? And Mr. Schoenfeld said, well, you know, the FBI is a secret organization, and we don't think that the faces of the agent should be shown. Well, this is rather curious, because if you go through the volumes published by the commission, you will see many, many pictures of FBI agents reenacting various events, sitting in the president's limousine, looking out of the sixth floor of the Book Depository building. And in not one of those cases has the director of photography thought it would be appropriate to decapitate the agent in question. And their faces are there, and they can be seen, and they can be recognized. Just in this one instance, the agent's head was removed. Mr. Schoenfeld was asked if he thought it might be possible to have the head put back on, as it appeared in the original photograph. And he said, well, no, because after all, nothing about the head is pertinent in any event, indicating that he somehow had missed the point along the line. Photographs and the commission's use of photographs raise a series of interesting questions. This is a photograph taken by a retired Air Force Major, Philip Willis, 5 minutes after the shots were fired. It's a picture of the Book Depository building. Here in the lower left-hand corner is a man who appears to be Jack Ruby. It's rather curious, because the commission said he wasn't there. He was nowhere near the Book Depository building on November 22, 1963, said the commission. Now, the commission felt compelled to publish this photograph along with all of the other slides taken by Major Willis for other reasons, because they showed some things the commission felt compelled to rely upon. But they were reluctant to publish a picture of a man who appears to be Jack Ruby. And so the commission published this picture instead. It's the same photograph, but what they've done is they've cropped off most of the man who appeared to be Jack Ruby, and then so that that one photograph would not appear more narrow than the others in the series, the commission then enlarged the photograph, as you see, so that it's the same width as the original one, but the relevant material was removed by the commission before publication. The basic question in the case, of course, is the, before we get to the question of who fired the shots, is where the shots came from.
Perhaps it would be useful to draw a diagram of the scene and discuss what the commission said happened, but what, on the other hand, the facts showed. This is the Book Depository building, Main Street. This is Main, Houston Street, and Elm Street. The president's limousine moved across Main, moved north on Houston, and made a sharp left-hand turn in front of the Book Depository building. It's a railroad bridge. It's running across a number of the streets, Elm, Houston, and Commerce, which is below, over the triple overpass because it passes over the streets. The commission said all the shots were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald, who was here on the sixth floor of the Book Depository building, and the tree over here. The commission said that the shots were fired when the limousine reached this point. That was the first shot, and the last shot was fired when the limousine was here. Over here is a hill, and on top of the hill is a wooden fence next to a concrete pergola over here. The commission went further. The novel said that Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, assassinated the president, and that he fired all the shots from the sixth floor of the Book Depository building. But the commission said, quote, there is no credible evidence which even suggests that any shots obtained from anywhere else. No credible evidence even suggests that shots were fired from elsewhere, said the judge. Well, let's look at the evidence and see if that statement even supports. Two-thirds of the witnesses in the Dealey Plaza area, two-thirds of them, said the shots did not come from the sixth floor of the Book Depository building, but the shots came from here, from behind the wooden fence on top of the grass and mower. Standing over here was a railroad employee, S.M. Holland. Holland was asked by the Dallas police to assume this position, this vantage point above the street, because it was a security place, and it was felt by the Dallas police that no one should be allowed up on there other than persons who worked in the railroad yard. Holland was an employee, 41 years of the Union Terminal Railroad, and during that period, for 17 years, he also had been a Dallas deputy sheriff. He was asked to go up there and see that only railroad employees who he knew and who he trusted would be permitted in that security position, and he did. He testified before an attorney for the commission. He said, when the shots were fired, I looked toward the wooden fence because I knew that some shots, or at least one shot, came from behind that fence. And when I looked there, I saw a puff of smoke drift out from behind the fence, drift in front of the fence, between the trees. There are trees here and bushes. The whole area is fairly heavily landscaped. Holland went further and said, gentlemen, I wasn't alone. There were at least seven of us up on that railroad bridge who looked here immediately upon the firing of the shot. A number of us went over in that area and conducted our own investigation. You ask any of those men, they'll tell you that the shots came from here, and they'll tell you that they saw puffs of smoke come from behind the fence. Well, that was all the commission had to hear, and so they declined to question the rest of the men on the railroad bridge. But nevertheless, seven men who were on this railroad bridge said to FBI agents, Secret Service agents, Dallas Sheriff's officers, or Dallas police officers, and the statements are contained in the archives and in the 26th volume. Seven men who were here said when the shots were fired, they looked in this direction, and they saw puffs of smoke come from here. Now back here was a railroad tower. It was occupied by one man, Lou Bowers, Jr. Bowers testified before the commission, before the attorney for the commission. He said, when the shots were fired, something attracted my attention to that wooden fence here. Something which I could not identify specifically, but something that, and afterward that, there was a dash in his testimony. And he was then interrupted by the commission lawyer, who changed the subject. Never got back to asking specifically, what was it, Mr. Bowers, do you think occurred that attracted your attention to the fence? Never asked that specific question again. And when I questioned Mr. Bowers just a bit more than a year ago in Dallas, a filmed interview with him, a tape recorded interview, I said, what happened at that occasion? And the dash followed the word that. And he said, I was interrupted by the commission lawyer. Evidently, did not want to go back, and I was just an invited guest, and if they didn't want me to tell them what I knew, well, it was up to them to make that decision. That was their decision. He went on to say what I was going to say was when the shots were fired, I looked here. My attention was attracted by something I could not specifically identify. It was a puff of smoke or a flash of light which attracted my attention. It's fortunate that we recorded that statement from Mr. Bowers because he was dead within 3 months after having made it, and the only record of his recollection at the time the shots were fired was that tape recorded and filmed interview that was conducted a bit more than a year ago. So now we have seven men on the bridge, one over here at the United States. Then we have O.B. Campbell, Vice President of the Book Depository Building. Campbell said, when the shots were fired, I looked over here, they came back from the railroad yard behind that fence in that general area. But I know they could not have come from the building, I was just in front of it. Sixth floor was just over my head. And I know the shots didn't come from there, they came from down in the area of the wooden fence. Campbell made that statement on November 22nd on the scene to reporters. Campbell was never called as a witness by the Warren Commission. Standing over here, for Mr. and Mrs. Newman and their two children, two infants. They were on television within 10 minutes after the shots were fired. An on-the-spot interview was conducted by WFAA TV, the agency affiliate of Dallas. They said that it was terrible. The shots came from behind us, from behind that fence. It was right about halfway between the railroad bridge and the crux of the book depository building. There's no question in our mind we fell down on the ground to avoid being hit and shot by fire. Standing over here was Mary Woodward and three of her colleagues, four employees of the Dallas Morning News. They wrote a story with the public. Well, Mr. Newman and Mrs. Newman were never called by witnesses by the commission, and they never were questioned by counsel for the commission. Mary Woodward and her three colleagues wrote an article which appeared in a special issue of the Dallas Morning News, in which they said there was a terrible ear-shattering sound coming from directly behind us. And the shots were fired. They gave their name, and of course, it was known where they were employed. They were never questioned by the Warren Commission. They were never questioned by counsel for the commission. And so it goes. The vast majority of the witnesses to this assassination, like 95% of them, were never questioned by the commission, never questioned by counsel for the commission. The closest spectator to the limousine when the fatal shot was fired was Charles Brehm. Brehm said, "I know a little bit about gunfire. I was under fire for a long time during World War II. He was a ranger and wounded twice during the Normandy invasion. If he sort of forget all about those things, and then something like swimming. So maybe swimming for some years and you don't swim for a long time. When you're frozen in the water, you start to swim. So perhaps you think you've forgotten how. And there I was under fire again. I knew where the shots were coming from. I could have sworn," he said, "that the first shot, or at least one of the early shots, came from this building. Like the sworn, one of the early shots came from there, but then I looked up, and when I saw it was the Dallas Sheriff's Building, I knew it was impossible." As to the origin of the fatal shot, the bullet which struck the president in the head, Brehm said, "I saw the effect of that bullet upon the president's head. I saw a particle of material which was later identified by Deputy Sheriff Seymour Weitzman, who found it in the street, as a portion of the president's skull. He saw it fly backward and to the left in this direction." And Seymour Weitzman, a Dallas deputy sheriff, he ran back here first because he too thought the shots came from there. There were 17 Dallas deputy sheriffs in Dealey Plaza when the shots were fired. Every single one of them ran right past the book depository building and began the search behind the wooden fence. And thereafter, Weitzman came out found a portion of his skull here and gave it to the Secret Service, which was later given to the doctors who conducted the autopsy at the Bethesda Naval Hospital at Bethesda, Maryland, and they confirmed the fact that there was indeed a portion of the president's head. He saw that fly backwards, for instance, in this direction. The first police officer to arrive behind the scene was Patrolman Smith. He said, "When I reached the area behind the wooden fence, I smelled gunpowder as if a weapon had been fired from there." Now, in addition to the statements of the eyewitnesses to what they heard and what they saw, in the case of one police officer, what he smelled, there, of course, is other evidence which would indicate the origin of the shot, at least the origin of the some of the shots. The doctors who examined President Kennedy and worked on his body and tried to revive him just after he died at the Parkland Hospital held a press conference just after the death. It's a little past 1 o'clock on November 22nd at the Parkland Memorial Hospital. Every single doctor who had observed the wounds in the president's throat, who was present at the press conference and made a statement as to the origin of the shot, said the bullet came from the front and from above. The wound in the throat was clearly an entrance wound. Dr. McClelland, in fact, one of the doctors, went a bit further. He said, "We know the difference between entrance wounds and exit wounds. Down here in Dallas, we have a chance to examine bullet wounds every single day, sometimes more than one a day. And that was clearly an entrance wound, small, neat puncture wound, not a large, jagged, stellate exit wound."
The distinction, he said, is quite clear. A physician can easily determine the difference between entrance wound and an exit wound. The wound in the president's throat was an entrance wound. He was shot from the front. The best way, I suppose, to determine the origin of the shots would be to examine the photographs and the x-rays taken of the president's body at the Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, taken by medical technicians under the direction of Commander Humes, who conducted the autopsy. These photographs and x-rays would, if examined, resolve once and for all the classic question in the case, the origin of the shots. These were therefore probably the most important documents in the case on that question. They were never seen by any member of the Warren Commission. They were never seen by any lawyer for the Warren Commission, and they were never seen by any associate, staff member, or any other person associated with the investigation conducted by the commission. The commission refused to look at the basic documents in the case. It's not that the commission was completely unconcerned about medical documents. The commission did examine and did publish, in fact, the dental chart showing the condition of Jack Ruby's mother's teeth in the year 1937, which I suggest would not even have been relevant had it been charged that Ruby bit Oswald to death. But the commission's standards as to what was relevant and what was not relevant were quite curious, I'm afraid. Brehm, the closest spectator to the limousine, who was on television November 22nd, whose name was in every newspaper published in America in stories dealing with the assassination, who was known to be perhaps the most important single eyewitness to the assassination, was never questioned by the commission or even by a lawyer for the commission. And he was right there, 15 feet from the car when the fatal shot was fired. Yet the commission did call as a witness Professor Revelo Oliver, who was in Illinois when the shots were fired. Perhaps you recall Professor Revelo Oliver. He was recently in the press. He resigned, about half a year ago, or perhaps a bit more, from the John Birch Society, claiming that organization was too liberal for him. And he had, before that time, written an article which was published in American Opinion, the unofficial organ of the John Birch Society, in which he presented this theory as to the president's death, which came to him while he was in Illinois one day. He said, as we all know, President Kennedy was part of the international communist conspiracy. But it has been suggested, said Professor Revelo Oliver, that during the early days of November 1963, the president decided to turn American, and therefore the international conspiracy decided it would be necessary to liquidate him, and that's why he was liquidated. Professor Oliver went further and said, however, I do not accept that theory, as tempting as it, and as logical as it all appears. I do not accept it, he said, because there is not one shred of evidence to support the conclusion that President Kennedy ever decided to turn American. He had some rather unkind comments to make about other presidents as well. He referred to President Roosevelt on several occasions as the war criminal in the White House. He referred to President Eisenhower as a knowing, conscious tool of the international conspiracy. And he didn't like Harry Truman very much either. Well, the commission devoted more than 100 pages of its publications to reprinting every single statement that Professor Revelo Oliver made in terms of his theories. And that was not enough. They then called Professor Revelo Oliver to come to Washington to testify before the commission. And for hour after hour after hour, Professor Revelo Oliver testified as to his theories. But not the witnesses to the assassination of the president. It cannot be said that the commission was in a great rush. There are those who call themselves commission critics who defend the commission by saying, after all, the commission was in a great hurry and it didn't have very much time and it did the best it could, and therefore its report was somewhat slovenly. That was not the problem. If Oswald had lived, an adequate investigation would have been completed in a period of weeks. And with all of the difficulty of defense counsel making objections and choosing of a jury, etc., the trial would have been completed in less than the 10 months it took the commission in its unopposed fashion to conduct its investigation and to issue its report. The commission secured a vast amount of evidence which had nothing whatever to do with the matter before it and refused to examine the basic evidence which would have indicated clearly that the commission's conclusion had nothing whatever to do with the facts. Well, we can't see the photographs and the x-rays. They, by order of President Johnson, they're locked up in the National Archives with a lot of the other material. Perhaps we can see what Jacqueline Kennedy had to say about the wounds. She was seated, of course, alongside of her husband, and after he had been struck, his head rested in her lap during the entire time that the limousine took them to the Parkland Hospital, and she was present in the emergency room as well for a period of time. And therefore, of all of the lay people, she was the one in the best position to make a statement as to the nature of the wounds which she observed. She made her statement to the commission freely and voluntarily. She told them about the wounds. The commission refused to publish her statement. If you read her testimony, you will see instead this statement, bracket, reference to wounds deleted, close bracket. But it does not mean that we may never see that. Along with a lot of the evidence, it's locked up in the National Archives by order of our president, but it is not to be locked up forever. It will be available to us in September, toward the end of September, in the year 2039. The acting archivist in Washington was asked why that year was chosen. And he said, well, you know, that's 75 years after the date of the issuance of the report. And it is presumed that no one alive today will be alive at that time. And therefore, no one alive today can be harmed by the disclosures which will come in 2039. Strange way to view evidence regarding the death of the president, I would suggest. And if, as the commission states, the evidence, all of it, proves conclusively that Oswald did it and did it alone, then I think the question which remains is this: who could possibly be harmed by the disclosures if they were made today? The commission said Oswald did it. The evidence shows that. No one can be harmed. But the logic has very little to do with the government's operation when it comes to the suppression of evidence. In fact, President Johnson doesn't speak very much about the Warren Commission report. He spoke about it once, I think, to my knowledge, once publicly. He held a press conference some months ago in order to discuss his impending visit to a hospital where he was going to have two more operations. And he called the press to discuss that matter with them. And one reporter, being somewhat impolite, said, Mr. President, why can't someone see the photographs and the x-rays at the present time? And don't you think there should be a new investigation, since the American people have indicated they do not believe the Warren Commission report any longer? This was just following the publication of my book, and following that there was a Harris poll and then a Gallup poll, which showed that at that time, 2/3 of the American people said they could not accept the central conclusion of the commission. 2/3 of the American people said that they believed that there was a conspiracy, that no lone man was in fact the assassin. President Johnson said, regarding the photographs and the x-rays, I think it would be a terrible thing, he said, to have those photographs and x-rays circulate around the country as part of a traveling carnival and shown to every sewing circle in America for purposes of commercial exploitation. I think we can agree that that should not be done. I don't know of anyone who suggested that. All that was suggested is that the members of the commission themselves should have seen the basic evidence in the case before making a ruling. And in the absence of that, because that did not take place, that leading pathologists at the leading universities in America be permitted to examine the photographs and the x-rays at the present time and make a report to the American people as to what conclusions can be drawn from that evidence. And President Johnson, who has issued the order to suppress this material, has not responded to that basic question which has been put to him. In terms of the necessity for a new investigation, President Johnson said just after having been informed that the polls showed that 2/3 of the American people rejected the commission's central conclusions, he said, "I believe every reasonable American accepts the Warren Commission report, period." So that's where we are at the present time. We cannot see the basic evidence in the case. The commission had a number of very serious problems it discovered after photographs were published, taken by an amateur photographer, Abraham Zapruder. Zapruder was standing over here. He was one of those few witnesses to the assassination who actually was called upon to testify. He was called upon to make statements as to not really where the shots were coming from, but to identify the photographs which he took. He used an 8mm camera. You've probably seen stills of the motion picture which have been published in this country in Life magazine. And he was standing there, and they asked him if he took the pictures. Was there for the purpose of identifying the photographs? Oh, yeah, I took those pictures. And what was that dangerous? The shots were coming over my head at the time. And so on occasion, inadvertently, the commission did have testimony from eyewitnesses as to the origin of the shots, which they quickly indicated must have been an error by the witness. Well, Zapruder's films are very interesting, because together with the eyewitness testimony, they establish a number of things. Together with the eyewitness testimony, they establish the fact that all of the shots were fired in less than 6 seconds, from the first shot to the last shot, less than 6 seconds. Now, the weapon which the commission claimed was the assassination weapon is an 1898 developed Italian carbine, a Mannlicher Carcano. Not exactly a precision instrument. If you buy them in batches of 25 or more, you pay $3 each for them. And it is this weapon which the commission claimed that Oswald used. Now, in the hands of the fastest firearms expert the commission could find, the weapon required 2.3 seconds just to work the bolt in between shots and pull that trigger without even any time required for aiming the weapon. 2.3 seconds. Now, total of 6 seconds were consumed at the most, actually less than that, but the commission concedes a total of six when you take the films together with the eyewitness testimony. And let's see how many shots were fired from an examination of the results of the bullets that were fired. One bullet, the first bullet, struck the president in the back, 2 inches to the right of the spinal column and beneath the right shoulder. We know this because we have the statements of the FBI agents who were present when the autopsy was being performed. It would be nice to look at the original draft notes prepared by Commander Humes, who conducted the autopsy, to see what he wrote just after he conducted the autopsy and before the government's case was in. In other words, to see what he thought he saw, not what he thought he should have seen. And those original notes are very valuable documents in the case. They rank together with the photographs and x-rays as the most important documents in the case. What did Commander Humes say in his original notes? Well, let's turn to volume 17, page 48, where we read this statement. "This is to certify that I, Commander J.J. Humes, have destroyed by burning my original draft autopsy notes." So they're gone. They're ashes now. Of course, they were not his notes. They were our notes. He was commissioned by the United States government to conduct that autopsy. He's a commander of the Navy, and he burned the important documents in the case. Well, we cannot examine his original notes, but we can examine the notes made by two agents of the FBI, Siebert and O'Neill, who were present when the autopsy was being performed. And their notes are quite explicit about what they saw and what they heard. Commander Humes examined a wound in the president's back, 2 inches to the right of the spinal column, beneath the shoulder. Commander Humes probed the wound with his finger and said the bullet had gone in but a very short distance and there was no point of exit. The bullet did not exit. But Commander Humes was astonished because the bullet was not present in the body. Could not understand what happened to the bullet. Therefore, phone calls were made to special agents of the FBI who were at the Parkland Hospital and an investigation was conducted there. Evidence was secured and given to Commander Humes. The evidence was this. Just after the president died, external cardiac massage was administered to the president at the Parkland Hospital, which his body was very roughly moved with the hope that it would start his heart to begin to beat. This failed, of course. And shortly thereafter, a bullet was discovered on the stretcher. Dr. Hume said, well, then the pattern is clear. The bullet entered the shoulder to the right of the spinal column, went in a very short distance, and during the external cardiac massage, the bullet was dislodged and fell out onto the stretcher. That's bullet number one. Now, bullet number two struck the president in the throat and left behind the entrance wound to which every doctor at the Parkland Hospital who made a public statement that day referred. That was the second bullet that was fired. The third bullet was fired, and that missed the occupants of the limousine, and in fact missed the limousine as well. It went down here and hit the curb on Main Street and struck a spectator named James Tague, who was standing there in the face. Either a portion of a bullet or a portion of the curb ricocheted and cut his face, and he received a superficial wound, but it did begin to bleed somewhat, and therefore, in addition to the president who was killed and Governor Connally, who was seated in front of the president who was severely injured, Tague was the only other person known to have been injured at all by the shots fired that day. So one bullet in the president's back, one in his throat, and one which missed, but a portion of the bullet, the curb struck a spectator. Another bullet was fired which hit Governor Connally. Governor Connally received many, many wounds. The commission said it was all one bullet. Well, perhaps it was, at least it was one bullet. And so that was the fourth bullet that was fired. The fifth bullet that was fired was the one which killed the president. It struck him in the head, drove a portion of his skull backward and to the left into the street. And an examination of the frame by frame stills taken from the Zapruder film showed that at frame 313, the bullet struck the president in the head. The commission concedes that to be so. Examination of the photograph shows the president was then leaning forward in that direction. By frame 321, which represents a frame taken less than half a second after the bullet struck the president in the head, he was driven very sharply to his left and to the rear, with his head, in fact, almost hitting the left rear portion of the seat, from this position to that position. That was caused by the bullet which came from behind the fence, from the right front, drove a portion of his skull backward into the street and drove him in the same direction. So we have five shots, at least five shots, and they came from at least two different directions. Well, the fact that the shots came from two different directions, at the very least, would seem to preclude the commission's conclusion that one man was the assassin. But there is an additional problem for the commission, and that is all the shots, as we've discussed, were fired in less than 6 seconds, and the weapon requires 2.3 seconds just as an interval period. Assuming the weapon was fully loaded at the outset before the first shot was fired, we're dealing with four interval periods. Four times 2.3 is well above 6 seconds. That weapon was not capable of firing five shots in 6 seconds. It wasn't capable of firing four shots in 6 seconds either, because with three interval periods, you have to multiply three times 2.3, which is the minimum time just for working the bolt and pulling the trigger without even aiming, and you're still almost at 7 seconds. The greatest number of shots that could have been fired from that weapon would be three, in the period of 6 seconds, would be three shots. Well, the commission then was faced with an impossibility, and the members of the commission and the staff of the commission were quite depressed at that time because they felt that their whole case had been destroyed by the evidence. But then one bright young lawyer, who is now the district attorney of Philadelphia, he was then an assistant district attorney, but his brilliance in putting this case together and saving all this embarrassment for the government was part of that which moved him into a position of higher importance. Harlan Specter came up with a most imaginative theory, most inventive theory. He said there were, in fact, only three shots fired. We know that because we start with the presumption that Oswald was the lone assassin. He was on the sixth floor of the Book Depository building. And we must now start with that basic presumption and try to move the evidence so that it fits the commission's conclusion, preconceived conclusion. This is the way Mr. Spector did it. The first bullet was fired, of course, by Oswald on the sixth floor of the Book Depository building, and it hit the president in the back of the neck, leaving behind, of course, the entrance wound, which was in the right shoulder. The bullet then continued on and ripped a large exit wound in the president's throat as it exited, leaving behind the small, neat entrance wound to which every doctor at the Parkland Hospital made reference to. Now, examination of the films and shows quite conclusively, and this corroborates Governor Connolly's own testimony and Mrs. Connolly's testimony, that Governor Connolly was hit at approximately 1.5 seconds after the president was hit. So according to the commission's theory in solving this problem, the bullet entered the back of the neck, exited the throat, and then hung out there in midair for about 1.5 seconds. And then at the appropriate moment, moved forward again and struck Governor Connolly in the back. That same bullet exited from the governor's fifth rib, shattered his fifth rib, in fact, turned portions of the fifth rib into secondary missiles which exploded and left behind a huge, gaping, sucking wound in his chest wall which almost killed him. The bullet then made a sharp right turn and fractured Governor Connolly's right wrist. After having done that, it made a U-turn and struck Governor Connolly's left thigh, which is why it was recovered from President Kennedy's stretcher after the external cardiac massage. And that was the commission's explanation. That was the first bullet, the second bullet missed, and the third bullet hit the president in the head from the rear, and for some unexplained reason, his skull went flying backwards, and he went flying in the same direction. But that is the explanation. Even accepting that rather strange explanation, some additional questions must be raised. Why did Governor Connolly react so much after the president reacted? Well, said the commission, he was struck just a glancing blow to the rib. That's a quote, a glancing blow to the rib. Dr. Shaw, who treated Governor Connolly, had a somewhat different view. He said, as the bullet exited, it smashed the fifth rib, many pieces. The pieces exploded and left behind this gaping, sucking wound that almost killed the governor. Said Dr. Shaw, I think he would have noticed it at once. Let's take the commission's case, then. Three shots were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald with the Italian man at the Carcano. All right. Let's see if it is possible, even in terms of the commission's own case. Let's accept the fact that one bullet did, this magic bullet did these rather strange things. Let's accept that and see if even that, if one concedes that, if then it is possible. I suggested to the commission that they, we didn't know then Oswald's score in terms of his ability with a weapon. It wasn't yet published. But I said to the commission, find out what his score is, and then get 1,000 Marines of the same ability that Oswald had, or even better ability, somewhat better, put them up on the sixth floor of the Book Depository building. Let's have a very pragmatic test. Have a limousine dragged past that area, pulled past the area by a pulley system, a dummy in the back seat, and let each Marine take the weapon with three bullets in it and fire one after the other. And let's see if one Marine can get off three shots in 6 seconds, two of which hit the president in the head and neck. And if 1 out of 1,000 can do it, even if just 1 out of 1,000 can do it, we can't say it proves that it's likely, but certainly we can then say you've proven that your theory is possible. We still have some of the problems with what the bullets did, but it would prove that at least one man could fire with that particular weapon and hit the president in the head or neck twice. The commission declined that rather pragmatic test and said it would conduct its test in its own way, and it did. It said, and this is perhaps the most extravagant single claim made by the commission in its 888 pages, although it has very rough competition. And that is the commission's statement that it tested the weapon under conditions which simulated those which existed on November 22nd, as the commission saw those conditions to exist. All right. We now know Oswald's score. When he last fired for score in the Marine Corps, he fired 191. That's 1 point above the minimum to qualify for the lowest qualification in the Marine Corps. 191. Or according to the Marine Corps expert who testified, 191 means he was, quote, a rather poor shot. Okay, now we know that the man firing is a rather poor shot. We're going to simulate that condition. We simulate that by securing the services of the three best riflemen in America, listed, all of them listed as masters by the National Rifle Association, the highest level of expertise on an international level. All of them fire thousands of rounds a day. Each of them are involved as professional riflemen. We have the three best riflemen in America. Okay. Now we have to put them on the sixth floor of the book depository building or something which simulates that. Sixth floor is over 60 feet above the ground. And so a perch was chosen in a field somewhere which was between 20 and 30 feet above the ground. Now Oswald fired at a moving target, we're told, the limousine as it moved through Dealey Plaza. Three experts were asked to fire at large stationary targets, not at moving targets at all. And when you come to the question of speed, the difference between firing at a stationary target and a moving target is a vast difference. But they used stationary targets. Now we come to the question of the weapon itself. These, after all, were experts, and they were somewhat concerned about having to fire such a weapon. One of the problems they discovered at once is that the telescopic sight was not correctly adjusted, so that when you looked through the sight, you saw one thing. If you pulled the trigger, you hit something else entirely. This caused a problem for them. And an additional problem is that you could not even be sure if you made an allowance for this adjustment, the difference between the disparity between what you saw and what you hit, even that would not be any good because the telescopic sight was not securely attached. It kept on wobbling all the time. This was a very difficult problem for them, and they were reluctant to fire such a weapon. And so the commission was kind enough to have the weapon given to a gunsmith. And the gunsmith welded two metal shims to the telescopic sight, and they were then attached to the weapon itself in order to stabilize the telescopic sight and to correct it as much as it could be corrected. Well, now the experts were ready. They were a third or a half as high as Oswald allegedly was. They were the three best riflemen in America. They were firing at stationary targets instead of moving targets. The weapon had been immeasurably improved, and they were all set. There was one additional problem which concerned the experts, and that is how much time you take that first shot. There was a tree here, a live oak tree. The commission said that the first shot was fired when the limousine was here because Oswald could not have seen the president before the limousine was here. Everything was backwards. Oswald didn't do it alone. The first shot hit the president had a view of Lee Harvey Oswald. So that's how they fixed the place for the first shot. Where the limousine was when the first shot was fired. It was over here, said the commission. And said the commission, the president can be seen reacting to the wound 0.8 seconds after that he has been visible to Lee Harvey Oswald on the sixth floor. In other words, Oswald had less than 0.8 seconds to fire the first shot. How do we simulate that condition? Very simply, quote, instructions to the experts, quote, take as much time as you wish for your first shot. Well, now we're ready for the test. The experts fired three shots. Each tried the test twice. Six shots, therefore, each expert. Total of 18 shots. Two of the experts, even under those somewhat more relaxed conditions, were unable to fire as quickly as Oswald did in each of their two efforts. Four tests, then, were unable of the six tests. Four were unable to match the speed. Now on the question of accuracy. Of the 18 shots fired, not one bullet, not one, hit the head or neck of the target. Not one. Oswald, with somewhat more difficult circumstances, allegedly fired three shots, two of which hit the head and neck. The experts, the three best experts in the country, couldn't get one bullet out of 18. On the head or neck of the target. What does this prove? Well, said the commission, this test proves that Lee Harvey Oswald and his weapon together had the capability of firing three shots, two of which hit the president in the head and in the neck. The basic problem which we've had in the case from the outset is not only that the government has not been frank with the American people, has in fact issued a false report, but that the media, which has an absolute responsibility to act in permitting a dissenting view to be heard, denied access to the American people, to those who had dissenting views to offer. For a period of almost 2 years, from the time the shots were fired that day in Dallas, there was not a single network, national radio or television program, which permitted one word of dissent from the government's case. There was about to be one. Les Crane, perhaps you remember that name, he had an ABC late night talk show, network program. He invited me to debate with Melvin Belli, who was Ruby's lawyer and who accepted the commission's conclusions. And I agreed, of course, and Belli agreed. And 2 days before the debate was to have taken place, Mr. Crane called me and said, I'm sorry, Mark, but you cannot be on the program. I said, really, why is that? And he said, well, the brass here at ABC has said that you have the affidavits and the facts and the evidence, and that would just tend to confuse the American people. I said, the program's been canceled on those grounds. He said, well, it's not been canceled. There will be a debate, but you can't participate. I said, really, who will be participating? He said, well, debating Melvin Belli will be Marguerite Oswald, Lee Oswald's mother. You may recall that. That was the only debate in 2 years. Belli, very flamboyant attorney, said, do you deny that in such and such a date, such and such a thing happened? And Mrs. Oswald's reply almost always was, I just know my boy and I think he's innocent. And that was the debate which was permitted during the first 2 years. And not only was it not possible in radio or television or through the press, but it also was impossible to have a book published in this country which dissented from the government's findings. I had finished my book and I took it to a publisher and they agreed to publish it. He signed a contract and sometime thereafter an executive from the publishing house said, I'm sorry that we cannot publish your book. I said, really, why is that? We have a contract. He said, I know, but we cannot publish it. Our official reason is we don't believe it will even break even. I said, how many copies must you sell to break even? He said, 5,000. This had been a very bad 2 years for us because we had given up our law practice, ended our political career, and gone to Dallas a number of times, and there was no income during that whole period. But I said, I'll take a loan from a bank, and I'll buy the first 5,000 copies, and I'll sell them on street corners. So go ahead with your publishing. He said, well, that's not the whole reason. We can't publish it, period, I'm sorry. And he hung up and never would give me any further explanation, except that he gave his answer was clear enough, although his reasoning seemed to be a little bit befuddled, and they did not publish the book. I then spent a year in pursuit of a publisher in this country. I went to the 15 leading publishers, and each of them said no. Each of them said yes at first, and then within a week or 10 days called and said, sorry, we cannot. I said, well, what's wrong? I have some 5,000 citations and references. Have your lawyers checked it out? Have you found one that's in error yet? One out of context, one inaccurate? No, they vouch for the accuracy. It's just that we cannot publish it, period. Well, I finally gave up and went to England, where I found a very old publishing house, very conservative house, the Bodley Head, and they agreed to publish the book. And shortly thereafter, an American firm that I had not tried, Holt Reinhardt and Winston, said they wanted to publish the book. I had not tried them because they publish everything which has been published, but been written by J. Edgar Hoover, including Masters of Deceit, which is, as you know, his autobiography. And also the president of the company is a very dear friend of Earl Warren's, and a close acquaintance of President Johnson. It just seemed like, and 11% of the company was owned at that time by a Dallas oil millionaire named Clint Murchison. And it just seemed like a very unlikely publishing house, and so I never did bother to go to them, but they were the ones who decided that they would publish it. But after they made that decision to publish the book, and I don't know about the other 15 publishers, I don't know why they changed their minds, but I do know what happened to Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, because I've become very friendly with a number of the executives, including the editor-in-chief. The assistant director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Dick LaRoche, called an executive at Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, a man by the name of Frank Close, an important executive, and summoned him to his office, his FBI office, in New York City on 69th Street, and said, John, that's J. Edgar Hoover, the Bureau, it's the FBI, and I, that was him, the assistant director, John, the Bureau, and I do not want you to publish that book. We would deplore it if you published that book by Mark Lane. And Mr. Close said, I'm sorry, we're committed, and we're just going to go ahead. There's nothing that could be done. He went back and talked with the editors, and they said they were going to publish the book, and the FBI had no right to step in and tell a private publishing house in this free enterprise system, right, tell a private publishing house that they could not have their work published, anything they wanted to publish. And so they did publish the book, and it sold more than 5,000 copies. Sold more than 5,000 copies the first day it was published, as a matter of fact. And within 2 weeks, it became a nationwide bestseller. Within 6 weeks, it was the number one best-selling book in the country, where it remained for half a year. And then when it was published in paperback just a little while ago, it quickly became the number one best-selling paperback book in the country, and it's sold now more than 1 million copies. And I think this is an indication that, first of all, the American people are deeply concerned about who killed President Kennedy and why he was killed. And it's an indication as well, I think, that the publishing industry must have been aware that there was that feeling out there, and that their decision not to publish the book, which was almost unanimous, and with the exception of one publishing house, would have been unanimous, that they knew that there was that feeling, and therefore their reluctance and their refusal to publish the work was in no way related to what they thought the result would be. But we've had too much government interference in terms of the functioning of justice in this country and the functioning of those who wish to dissent from government findings. If you go to the National Archives, you'll find 35 files there of the 1,551 called the basic source materials relied upon by the Warren Commission. And of those 1,551 files, 35 are all about me. Every single place I lectured, at a university, a college, at a church, there will always be agents of the FBI and the Secret Service in the audience. For example, there was a report from San Francisco. And here there might even be agents of the CIA, for all I know. Report of two FBI agents in San Francisco. Mr. Lane was here in San Francisco the last 3 days. He spoke at 5 colleges. We enclose a summary of his remarks, which in no way are different from the testimony he gave to the commission, and we enclose 21 reels of tape of his remarks at the various colleges. Now, I thought that this ended when the commission ended. I thought perhaps naively, perhaps that the FBI agents were just following me around the country to see what I was going to say and give this information to the commission. I don't know exactly what they wanted it for, since I said nothing that I had not said to the commission first. But I spoke at a Catholic girls' college a few days ago, Loretto Heights in Denver, Colorado. And after the lecture, it was a rather small school, and after the lecture was finished, one of the sisters came to see me and said, did you know that there were 3 agents of the FBI here tonight? And I said, well, how do you know? She said, well, I work in the poverty program, and I come in contact with them in Denver, and I know them by name. And they were there in the back. And I said, do they have a tape recorder? She said, well, I couldn't see any tape recorder. And I remember one occasion where I spoke in a little church, tiny little church. There were only 50 people in the audience a couple of years ago in Boston. And I could see everybody, only 50 people, and I was right there. And I didn't see anybody with a tape recorder, but they had a tape recording of that as well. So they're very effective. And if a couple of the gentlemen are here this evening, I'd like to address just a few words to them, if the rest of you will excuse me for just one moment. If You will tell Mr. Hoover, whoever it is that you're on speaking terms with in that organization, that it is my feeling that, first of all, as a taxpayer, I protest this nonsense of having agents follow me all over the country and record the same speech day after day, first of all. And secondly, if you showed the same dedication to trying to find out who killed your president, and if you spent as much time in Dallas as you do following me around the country, perhaps you would have made a more perfect record, and perhaps the Warren Commission would have known, if they did not know, who killed the president and why he was killed. I've had some strange problems with the government, as a matter of fact, since I became involved in this. Not long after I started this investigation, I was stopped in front of my house, New York City, on a rainy morning as I left with my attaché case, and there were two men standing out front, and one said, "Are you Mark Lane?" I pleaded guilty at once. And he said, "We're going to confiscate your attaché case and search it now." I said, "I beg your pardon." He said, "We understand that you have taken a file from the offices of the FBI. I said, "Well, who are you?" And he said, "I'm a special agent of the FBI. I said, "Do you have any credentials?" And he took out a little case, green cards, two green cards on the inside. The outside is made of simulated black leather. And took out his case and he flashed it like that and put it back in his pocket. I said, I'm sorry, I don't read that quickly. May I look at it again?" And I wrote down his name and his special secret FBI number. And went through the same procedure with his colleague. I gave that information to the Chief Justice the next time I testified. I said, "These two men came to see me, want to seize my papers. I know how strongly you feel about civil liberties," etc. He seemed completely uninterested, I must say. But I gave him the names and the numbers of the two agents. And then I said, "All right, now I know who you are and you know who I am. What can I do for you?" And he said, the first one, there was only one who spoke. The other one just stood there. And he probably could speak, but he didn't speak. But the speaking one said, "Yeah, just a moment. Just a few moments. Do we have to go somewhere?" The gentleman said, "I understand that you have taken a file from the office of the FBI. And I said, "Well, is there one missing there? Is that the problem?" And he said, "This is no moment for levity." I said, "I'm inclined to agree with you. I was wearing this suit and I was getting absolutely soaked." They were both wearing trench coats, of course. And I said, "Look, if you ask your supervisor to contact me the way any government agency contacts anyone, by sending a letter to him, I will be happy to respond. But I don't expect federal cops to come in front of my house and to question me in this fashion. I'm a lawyer, member of the New York State Legislature, and I'm not used to being treated this way by any government agency. And no citizen should be used to be treated that way. No citizen should be treated that way. So just send a letter to me and I'll answer it." He said, "We're going to have to examine your attaché case now." And I had difficulty getting out of that spot. They surrounded me as much as two people can surround one person. And I said, "Excuse me," but they didn't move, so I pushed one gently out of the way, and I entered into a taxi which was waiting. And I've never received that letter from Mr. Hoover, so I suppose they really weren't as interested in that as they indicated at that time. The only other difficulty I've had with the government is after I was in England trying to find a publisher, and I had toured there. I spoke at Oxford and Cambridge and the London School of Economics and universities in about 12 or 13 countries in Europe at that time. And I was struck by the treatment that I received by the customs officials and the immigration officials when I landed. In France, for example, as soon as I landed, an official came to see me and said that there are a number of reporters here and television journalists who would like to interview you. Would you be willing to speak with them? I said, "Surely." He said, "Well, if you give me your passport, I'll take it through for you, and your luggage will go through customs without being opened. We appreciate the mission which brings you here. And so this was a very unusual and very kind treatment everywhere I went. The only difficulty I had with the immigration authorities was when I landed in New York City, which is the city in which I was born. And I landed there and I showed my passport to the clerk who was behind the little desk, and he took it and he looked through this book. They call it the Black Book or the Lookout Book. It's in alphabetical order. And he turned to the L page, and there was, it's the book in which there are the names of narcotics addicts and jewel smugglers and gold thieves, people like, and me, people like that. And there was my name, Lane, comma, Mark, G19, it said after it. And I said, what is my name doing in your book, sir? And he said, can't give you that information now, it's secret, he said, but I'll be back, just wait here. I waited because he took my passport and came back about 20 minutes later and said, you can come in now. They generally say welcome to the country when you land. He didn't say welcome to the country, he just said you can come in now, and gave me my passport. And I said, why is my name in your book? He said, I can't give you that information. I asked him for the name of the supervisor. I asked the supervisor why my name was in the book. Couldn't tell me. I ended up seeing the head of the immigration authorities for the port of the Kennedy Airport. And he invited me into his very nice walnut paneled office and said, won't you sit down, Mr. Lane, would you like a drink? I said, no, I would just like to know why my name is in your book. He said, how about a cigarette? No, I just really want that information. And then he sat back in his chair, put his feet up on the desk and said, so you think your name is in our book, do you? So that's the non-direct approach. And I said, yes, would you like to know why I think that? He said, yes, why do you think that? I said, I saw it there about a half an hour ago. He said, let me assure you, Mr. Lane, your name is not in our book. I said, let me assure you, sir, my name is in your book. And this intellectual game continued for a few minutes, with neither side giving at all. And I said, I've just thought of a way to resolve the whole question. He said, how is that? I said, let's go out and look at the book together and we'll see if my name is there. He said, you cannot look in that book. That book is top secret. I said, I just looked at it a few minutes ago. He said, well, you cannot look in it again. And that's the way it was left. And I mentioned this at Columbia University some time ago when I spoke there. And afterwards, a young man came back to see me and said, Mr. Lane, I am from the immigration department. I thought he was going to say, you're under arrest or some such thing. But he didn't. He said, I'm leaving in 3 weeks anyway, and I'm in complete sympathy with your position. And I'm going to try to find out, if I can, why your name is in the book. I said, marvelous. And he came to see me the next day, and he said, I have a photostatic copy of the page in which your name appears, and there it was. He gave it to me, and it said G19 after it. And I said, what does G19 mean? And he said, well, that's from the top secret regulation book, and I've ripped out that page for you. And I read it, and it said, G19, if the subject is otherwise admissible, he should be permitted to enter the country, but first he must be delayed for an appropriate period of time, during which time the FBI and the Department of Justice will be notified telephonically and immediately of his presence in the country. So they knew I had come home. If they hadn't read it in the newspaper first, then they knew it by through this top secret method. I don't take it very seriously, as you see, but I think there are serious implications which are involved. And that is the whole effort of a society to harass those who have an opinion which is different from the orthodox view. And this is a problem which is now being faced by Mr. Garrison in New Orleans. I know if you've read the newspapers, you know that he's a clown. He's conducting a circus down there. He's concerned about publicity and about political advancement, and he's not serious. However, if you are familiar with the facts, instead of being familiar with the public image developed by the press, you will know instead that Mr. Garrison is one of those rare district attorneys in this country who is also an intellectual, that he does have a communication problem with the press, because when he quotes Virgil, they want to know what Virgil's last name is. But But Mr. Garrison is, in my view, not only the best district attorney in this country, and I'm a defense lawyer, and I have been for some 17 years now, not only the best, but he's put together the best staff I've ever met. I've spent a week in New Orleans. I've seen all of the evidence which he has secured, all of it. He showed all of it to me. I'm not reluctant to comment upon anything which I have discovered myself, but of course it's impossible for me, after he has confided in me, to release the information which he has. If he were to release it at the present time, then the convictions which he will secure in New Orleans, and he will secure them, he will convict those who planned the assassination of President Kennedy. There's no doubt in my mind about that. He has the evidence, and he will prove it. He will prove his case in court. But were this information to be released to the press now, he's a publicity seeker, but he keeps on saying no comment every time they ask him a question. But were he to say anything else after the convictions, there could be a reversal based upon his comments to the press, thereby making it impossible for Mr. Shaw and the others who will be arrested to secure a fair trial. I know that the Chief Justice, of course, will look over the appeal very closely in this case, and I think one has a responsibility not to make it impossible for a conviction to stick when there is a conviction. I can tell you this about the case, though, that the American people will be shocked, as they have never been shocked before in their history, after that trial begins in New Orleans. The Garrison will prove that a powerful domestic force, which remains today as part of the American structure, planned the events which culminated in the death of President Kennedy, that no foreign power was involved, and that anti-Castro forces were involved in the execution of the plan and firing the shots which killed the president, and that no evidence seems to suggest that Oswald shot anybody in Dallas on November 22nd. What I find most amazing about Garrison's evidence when I examine it is that I've spent more than 3 years examining the Dallas scene, talking to witnesses in Dallas, and a few in New Orleans, but not so many in New Orleans. I mean, I was interested in Clay Shaw, alias Clay Burke, and his name appears in my book because I thought he was a person who required much further investigation, as I said, in Rush to Judgment. His name does not appear. The first man now charged with conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy, his name does not appear anywhere in the Warren Commission report. It's not present in the 26 volumes. It's not present in the 1,551 files. It's not present in the 25,000 interview reports and re-interview reports conducted by the army of 6,000 FBI agents. They found everything in their multi-million dollar investigation except the names of the persons who were involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. And the task is going to be very difficult for Garrison down there. His life has already been threatened. Mine has been too, but not recent, no more. Now everybody's threatening Mr. Garrison, and I have no important role to play any longer, which is sort of relaxing, I must say. But there was a period I received more than 100 death threats in the last 3 years, many through the mail and a few by telephone. I've really not known what to do with those threats. I know I've discussed this with Garrison because he's receiving them now. And he said, what did you do about it? And I said, well, you know, I don't know what to do. Some people said I should turn them over to the FBI. Other people said that would be like Custer calling for more Indians. So I just put them in a file called death threats. And Mr. Garrison's doing much the same thing with the threats that he is receiving at the present time. I was struck by the fact that when I went to New Orleans recently, he came to the hotel and we talked for a while, and then that evening he invited me to his house to have dinner with him, with his family. And when I arrived, he lives in a sort of a simple wood frame house just outside of the downtown area. There was no guard standing around, and I rang the bell and he came to the door by himself, and I said, don't you have a guard out here? And he said, well, people ask that question. He said, but you and I know now who killed President Kennedy, what forces were involved. They could kill the president with the greatest security precautions in the history of America to protect an American president. You think a guard outside of my door will make any difference? Well, if Garrison lives till that trial date, and I hope that he will, and I think his life is in danger, but should he live to that trial date, then on that date, he will submit evidence to the American people, and this case will be taken, be placed where it belongs, out of the publishers' offices and out of the newspapers and out of the books, and placed where it belongs and where for 3 years we've been trying to get it, into a courtroom where there will be rules of evidence which will prevail, and where a jury of 12 men representing the American people, 12 men and women, will hear the evidence and render a verdict. And on that day, the American people will find out who killed their president and why he was killed. And they will discover as well why it is that the Warren Commission was unable, or unwilling, but unable in terms of its own views of what national security required, why the Warren Commission was unwilling to tell the American people what the facts are, because no government in the history of civilization has ever disclosed voluntarily the kind of information that Garrison will present to the American people someday later this year in New Orleans. Thank you.